Mike, can I ask a quick question while we're waiting?
Though there are people are arriving. So we're talking at the front of the auditorium while people filter in. Go ahead.
Okay, got it. I was just curious, is it, are we sort of aiming for an hour with Q&A?
I think we have the slot goes for an hour 15,
Okay.
including Q&A.
Okay, perfect.
I can double check that in my calendar.
No, that's correct.
All right, we have confirmation. And then there's a follow-up meeting with NSF staff. That's a separate thing.
Perfect.
Cool. All right. So it looks like people are still filtering in. So I will wait a moment or two for the numbers to level off.
Are you there in person?
I am in the building at NSF right now. Yeah.
Got
And
it.
I was on campus at Hopkins on Monday.
Nice.
Are you there or are you in
I'm
New York?
actually
Where
in
are
San
you?
Diego right now, speaking
San
from a
Diego, of
hotel room,
course.
because I'm in a different meeting,
Thank you
sadly.
for joining. Okay, I feel like we're at sort of trickle level of increase at the moment in terms of participants. So I will kick this thing off. Thank you, everybody, for coming to the National Science Foundation SAIS Directorate Distinguished Lecture Series. And I'm very honored for today's speaker to introduce Professor Suchi Saria. She is the John C. Malone Associate Professor of Computer Science and of Statistics, and also Health Policy at the Johns Hopkins University. And one of the reasons that we were very excited to invite Suchi as an NSF SAIS Distinguished Lecturer was because she's working on so many interesting things. And of course, that also made scheduling her talk a bit of a challenge because she's doing so many interesting things. And in fact, I found out that she's calling in today from San Diego because there's another set of meetings that she's involved in there, and she's taking time out to kind of talk with us. So, but we're here now, and I'm really glad that she's able to join us. Her work has received recognition in numerous forms, including Best Paper Awards at machine learning, informatics, and medical venues. But since this is an NSF event, I'll highlight her NSF Computing Innovation Fellowship, which she got in 2011. And it's also worth mentioning that she is the founder and CEO of Bayesian Health, which is just a great name. I love that name. And in the words of Forbes magazine, founder Suchi Saria's startup, Bayesian Health, offers software to help hospital staff identify high-risk patients. Its products evaluate health history and medical records to empower healthcare providers to take timely, life-saving actions for patients at risk of critical conditions like sepsis, deterioration, and pressure injuries. The company has raised $15 million from investors, including Andreessen Horowitz, and another $15 million in grants from the National Institutes of Health, DARPA, and most importantly, and I'm sure that it says that in the Forbes magazine blurb, the National Science Foundation. She's given various flavors of, this is now me again. She's given various favorite flavors of TED Talks, as well as keynote slots at many major conferences in AI, machine learning, and medicine. I personally have been following Suchi's work since she was a PhD student with Daphne Koller, and I'm eagerly anticipating hearing what she'll share with us today. So let's all give a warm, albeit silent, welcome to Dr. Suchi Saria. Thank you for being here, Suchi.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be able to join. I wish I could see the folks who are there in person or the folks who are attending. I structured my talk, when NSF sent the invite out, I got a whole bunch of folks from completely different areas of computing and math and CS and other areas who wrote to me saying, "Oh, you're giving this lecture," which made me think the audience that is hearing this or is the intended audience is very broad and not just people who do AI machine learning research all day long. So with that in mind, I've structured my talk where it won't be entirely boring to people who don't do AI ML all day. It'll be a collection of broad description of problems, a little bit of an overview of sort of a 10-year journey and sort of bringing some ideas to life. And then in some areas, we'll do a deep dive in recent state-of-the-art ideas on the AI ML front. With that in mind, I'll jump in. So here's a sort of a paper. Generally, I wouldn't have had the dates there and done a real-time poll on this. And the paper is basically talking about how rapid advances in information science, computer science, is going to absolutely completely transform the field of medicine and the practice of medicine, and reimagine the role of caregivers. And you know, when you read it, you think, at least for me, I feel like it's the kind of thing I would expect to be written today because of the ex amount of excitement for what computer science can do. Except the article was written in 1970, which, you know, as a researcher, I want to kind of hear learn from history. So it's when I read that, I was kind of disappointing to me because I'm like, holy majoli, what if 30 years from now, you know, we've made all these promises now, and 30 years from now, we look back and we sort of still feel like, you know, we were so excited, and then, you know, not as much materialized. Here's another article from 1994, which says, a report card of computer-assisted diagnosis, grade C. So, as a young researcher or younger researcher, when I was younger, looking into this sort of really bothered me. And so, one of the things that I often think about is how to make sure we don't repeat this. And that sort of inspired a lot of the trajectory of my work. But part of what's also exciting is it's not just about the methods work. It's not just about the tech itself. It's also about the ecosystem within which the tech is be getting embedded. And a lot has changed about the ecosystem in which the tech is getting embedded, which is, I think, finally we're at this turnaround point where we are going to see this crazy rapid adoption, or at least I can palpably see very meaningful difference in the last 4 to 5 years. So first evidence of that is this slide is already outdated. There are upwards of about 500, maybe 600 now, maybe more AI-enabled devices that have been approved by the FDA in the last you know, in the last few years. Many of these are in imaging. I'll talk a little bit more about and sort of opportunities in multimodal AI, but there's definite evidence for, you know, ideas going from what we would call the lab bench to the bedside. In terms of the opportunity, real world practical impact these ideas can have, like here are some real technologies today that are live, all invented in the last like 5 to 6, 7 years, and really core fundamental NSF funded technology translating. So the first one is basically the ability today, you know, when you have today's ultrasound machines, often very expensive, they're hard to access. But turns out, like, there are new kinds of low-cost handheld ultrasounds getting built, coupled with AI on it, which now makes it so that you don't have to go for an ultrasound necessarily to a very expensive, like, facility and slice in, you know, ultrasound experts or specialists. You can start to get screening for complications that could have been caught earlier at the urgent care center, which is sort of your nearby urgent care center, which, you know, is you're much more likely to frequently visit. So in a very good example of how point of like AI combined with novel point of care diagnostics is dramatically improving access to high quality care by both making it cheaper and making it easier to access. The third example here of diabetic retinopathy is one where today patients have to go to, again, a specialist to get diagnosed for diabetic retinopathy, again, making it less and less likely that they know about it. You'd have to have a premeditated reason for being there in the first place. This is a fully autonomous device that you can now put in a primary care provider's office. And what the device does is it allows you to take a retinal scan and automatically identify if the person has diabetic retinopathy. Again, the whole thing is cheaper than you would have gone. It would have been going to a specialist. But what's also exciting is, again, you go to a primary care provider way more often than you go to a specialist. So your chance of basically accessing the technology, knowing if you're at risk, is much higher, and which means you can more proactively treat. The last example is an example in the middle of stroke diagnosis, where essentially, you know, in stroke, time is money. Every you know, like, minute matters. So the ability to take an image for AI to automatically interpret it, flag high risk cases, and make sure those patients are getting transferred to the right center in a timely fashion means you're not waiting for the specialist to be able to have the time to go read it. It dramatically accelerates our ability to get treatments, and as a result, can be life-saving. So really compelling examples of solutions that leverage AI to improve, meaningfully improve quality of care and patient outcomes. I'm going to talk a little bit more about multimodal AI. So, like, another super exciting thing that's happened since 2010, which is not that far back in the future, in the past, is the advent of electronic health records, right? So prior to 2010, a lot of our infrastructure in the US was very focused on paper records. You'd go to a clinician's office, they would be writing your notes in paper records or some local infrastructure. And then effectively, you'd go the next time, they would hear you again and respond. But what's very, very much changed in the last 14 to 15 years is now most health systems in this country, like hospitals, patient practices, et cetera, provider practices have gone electronic, which means all of the information about like where your history, what was given to you, how you responded, et cetera, is now in computable form. And what that now makes possible is suddenly giving us a view into what is not just a patient's journey, but also the quality of care, new opportunity for use this data to invent new treatments for earlier diagnosis, more precise targeting of treatments, but then also deliver care in a much more precision way by using this information to, in real time, change the way we practice. So this is the what I view as one of the most interesting, compelling ecosystem shifts that have happened that suddenly make medicine, which is a massive enterprise, suddenly the use of computing within medicine to meaningfully transform both the way care is delivered and human outcomes. After this slide, I'll start going into more of the details of like the technical details. This is my last high-level overview, but a lot of what you'll see is very heavily colored from also my real-world experience of taking research, almost a decade of research and methodological ideas we developed in the lab, and then translated it through this company that Michael described as Bayesian Health. When we call it Bayesian, why do we call it Bayesian? It's not necessarily because it's using purely Bayesian techniques. It's because the way to think about this is, the Bayesian way of reasoning, when possible, is the most sound, optimal way of reasoning, where you can incorporate prior data with real-time data, do uncertainty quantification, know what data to trust, what not to trust, and update as new information arrives. And the idea is to be able to give this kind of quality and capability to our frontline care providers in, one of the most important areas that matters to all of us, which is our human health. And how do we do this in a way that uses state-of-the-art technology to do that? And so that's sort of the company we started, Bayesian Health. And Bayesian, through Bayesian, I've had the chance to learn and develop a lot of real-world experience partnering with health systems nationally, both big and small, not just sort of like, very rich academic medical centers, but also rural community hospitals where, there's really great need for these kinds of technologies to uplevel the quality of care. And so you'll hear a little bit of like what are some learnings there that has then informed a lot of the methodologic research you'll see that I'll talk about. Okay, so with that in mind, I'll dive in into sort of more of a concrete example. I've been really lucky to be funded by NSF and on my methodologic work and have partnered in a variety of applying these methods in a variety of practical disease areas and autoimmune diseases and neurologic diseases and infectious diseases and so on and so forth as inspiration for the foundational work we do. Today, for the purpose of this talk, I will pick one example area called sepsis. I've done about a, really gone deep in this space and done about a decade of work to build sort of really solutions that are going to meaningfully advance standard of care. So I'll use this as an example to kind of describe how 10 years of like bunch of ideas fitting together to get you to where we are today. So just a little bit of background. Sepsis is an example of a diagnostic error. Today, diagnostic errors, that's still considered the third leading cause of death. These are often because the patient didn't get the right diagnosis. They got a delayed diagnosis, which then, maybe the treatments were there had they gotten diagnosed, and there would be an opportunity to meaningfully change the outcome. Why does it occur? All sorts of reasons, right? Like it's easy to miss data. It's easy to be biased in interpreting results. It's easy to over-rely on impression, burnout, failure to order tests, Sepsis is an example of an area where delays in diagnosis or misdiagnosis leads to a massive toll on human outcomes. And it turns out in hospitals, this is the leading cause of hospital death. For sepsis in particular, once you're in this area, once again, light stroke in sepsis, time is money. Every hour in sepsis, there's data showing has meaningful association with increase in mortality. So turns out in sepsis, we do have a num we do have some available treatments, but the treatments are more effective. You can identify the condition early. So the big bottleneck we want to solve is how do we make sure we identify a patient who is septic as early as possible in the course so that we basically can have a shot at rescuing them. One in three patients, once they reach septic shock, which is like a patient gets infection. Infection leads to systemic response, which starts to again attack your organ systems, leading to sometimes organ failure and organ damage and death if not controlled in a timely fashion. This is your immune system becoming overactive in response to tackling your infection. Now, it turns out when you're in that reactive state where you reach shock, mortality rates are like one in three, so really, really high. Here we started working this about in 2013, 2014, and 2015, wrote one of the earliest papers showing how you could take EMR data, like electronic health record infrastructure that is now commonplace or becoming commonplace at the time, combined with machine learning techniques that make sense of this data to be able to identify sepsis early. So that was like, 2015, it showed promise. But then to get it from this could be promising, to get it to something that is very practical, deployable, and usable was another 10 years. And I'll talk a little bit about what it did take. And here are, I have photos here of some of the students who contributed a great deal and now have a very good careers that they're pursuing post their graduation. And this work has now led to like a huge amount of downstream, like thousands of now publications. The site is now outdated in terms of the amount of activity in this space. I'll start with an end result, which is from a recent result. This is a study. These are three studies we published on the cover of Nature Medicine. They came out in 2022 summer. What the paper showed was super high level, massive. These were pretty large studies. These were pragmatic studies. They were done across five hospital sites, both academic and community, overall spanning nearly three quarters of a million patients, so 750,000 patients. This was work funded by an SBIR grant in part to do the pragmatic study and some of the analyses of the pragmatic study. There were 4,400 clinicians who participated as part of the study. It's one of the biggest practical trials in medicine with AI. And what we showed was the first one was, clinicians would often say, especially at a place like Hopkins, right, ranks very well in safety quality. Well, we're already very good. I don't know the extent to which AI can really help me. And so here, what we showed was essentially using AI running in the background at first, the ability to identify sepsis meaningfully earlier than when physicians did. On average, 5.7 hours earlier on patients who ended up becoming septic and eventually died in the hospital. So, like, the frontline physicians, so this is the system running in the background. It's not impacting standard of care yet. So that's sort of like 10x higher performance than alternative tools that exist and current standard of care. The next thing was, well, okay, well, maybe this is possible to identify. The next question is, will clinicians adopt, right? So the bottleneck of clinician adoption or physician adoption has been a big one. And part of it is like physician trust in this technology and how can it be delivered in a way that they trust. So with NSF, we're funded on this grant called Human Machine Teaming. How do we enable humans and machines to be more effective together than each individually alone? And using some of the ideas in that grant, we built this sort of we did sort of both a pragmatic human factor study as well as quantitative evaluations and showed over a 2.5 year period in a large, with 4,400 clinicians using the platform and tool, nearly 89% physician adoption. This is like, typical adoption for CDS tools or alerts, alarms, and the EMR is something like 10%. So a very meaningful improvement over current current approaches. And then, in sepsis, we know if you have earlier detection and you have meaningful adoption, then you expect to see changes in outcome. And some of the outcomes you expect to see change is reductions in mortality, reductions in complication rates, which tends to also then cut utilization. And that's sort of what we saw. Really personally rewarding to me to see the real impact on human life with sort of nearly 20% reductions in mortality in this pragmatic study. So let's talk a little bit about sort of what were some learnings along the way. Like, what did it take us to get there? And I could be here for 2 days giving lots of talks and lots of components. So I'll highlight just sort of a few example ideas of the rest of this talk. But super high level, I put sort of challenges in four big buckets. The first were around modeling, which is, ultimately we're looking for, so there were a huge number of modeling challenges we needed to solve from sort of how current state of the art looked like. So the first one was, ultimately sepsis is still 2 to 3% of the population. It's not like something that you see in 30% or 40%. So it's a what I would call a needle in a haystack problem. So you've got to find the signal to noise problem is real here because one, it's not that prevalent, but two, there are lots of things that mimic sepsis, so that it's an easy way to miss and to misidentify or to have a very high false alerting rate, which basically makes the system not very useful in practice and very likely low likelihood of adoption. So how do we solve the signal to noise problem? The second thing was that, a lot of times when we are learning from data, having high quality access to ground truth is very important. But what should ground truth look like? And how do we develop ground truth in a scalable fashion, right? So we can build high quality AI models, but part of the challenge is if they need millions of labels and we need our physicians to sit down and chart review each chart, and each chart review could easily take 30 minutes, how do you then get access to high quality labels from which you can learn? So the opportunity to do, build AI replay machines that basically are human in the loop that allow you to generate high quality gold standard data that is the equivalent of human adjudicated data or expert adjudicated data. It's very easy to overfit to multimodal data. So a lot of the opportunities in leveraging ideas from causal inference combined with high dimensional learning or high dimensional multimodal learning to be able to build models that are more grounded in causal reasons we know can impact, which then allows us to build models that are more intelligible and actionable and higher accuracy as well. Then there are lots of things around bias in data collection, missingness. And so, like for instance, a common assumption we often make when we do machine learning algorithms is think about data as missing, missing not at, sorry, missing at random or missing completely at random. Turns out in these scenarios, often when a measurement is made, it was intentional, or measurement is not made, it can be intentional as an informative. So you want to take into account missingness. So the missingness completely at random or the MCAR assumption is completely is often false in practice. And you can actually do a whole lot better if you think harder about the missingness patterns. And so real opportunities for leveraging, for creating methodology that leverage the complexity of the domain to be able to build methods that are far more accurate. And a lot of these ideas led to a collection of papers in NeurIPS and ICML and Nature Medicine and New England Journal of Medicine, and you'll hear about a few of these. The second bucket of challenges was around what I would call safe, reliable, and now robust learning, which is it was one thing to take data from a lab and learn these models and to be able to show in analysis that the method performs really well. But when we move these systems from the lab to the real world and across many sites, you suddenly have to think about, how do we monitor for ships and drifts? How do we monitor for things that are changing, and how do we update over time? And so I'll go a lot deeper into that. The next piece is delivery. How do we deliver it in a way? So the human machine teaming component, how do we deliver it in a way that builds clinician trust? And finally, how do we do real world pragmatic evaluations? Where I think it's such an exciting opportunity here. Historically, we've relied on like massive premeditated RCTs that are ridiculously expensive and as a result, extremely hard to do, and a key bottleneck for bringing new ideas into the field. So one of the questions is, now that we have EMRs, we have the ability to embed technologies within the EMR, there's a lot of variation in provider practice pattern. Can we take advantage of the variation to be able to design trials that are far more statistically efficient, but also can run in real-world scenarios that more represent the real world, and can still give you really high-quality evidence, so that now suddenly the cost of the trials that you're implementing go way down, and the ability to leverage these trials to show impact improves, the speed at which we can show impact improves dramatically. So I'll start with the first component first. So let's talk a little bit about the modeling pieces first. So traditional state of the art, traditionally what people were doing was, I kind of can bucket them into, four key areas. The quality of the inputs, which is what are the kinds of data you're putting into your machine, the quality of the labels, which is how much label data do you have, the quality of the learning strategies, which is how are you building learning strategies that really push for the kinds of complexity you have in this domain. And then finally, rather than a frozen system, the ability to build in monitoring, tuning, and bias mitigation strategies to be able to get to systems that are far more accurate than what exists. So current state of the art, typically you have limited set of inputs because they're often thought of as diagnostics. You want to collect only a small number of inputs that you can collect in a very controlled fashion. And then you're combining them often with labels. Very often, you have very limited data to train from because of the burden of label acquisition. And then when people have tried to do large label studies, they're basically collecting really noisy labels based on what is called billing codes, which is not very good. Third, they're often using off-the-shelf learning strategies, which are generic learning strategies and not really tuning and tailoring to the kinds of complexity we see in this data. And fourth, most existing models are frozen and they don't really sort of adapt to the real world. So we push on all four of these dimensions to be able to see the quality of results I showed you upfront. And so here's a really simple, pragmatic, understanding of how much each of these dimensions matter. So here, what I'm showing you on the x-axis is sensitivity, which is your detection rate, and on the y-axis is positive predictive value, which means false true alerting rate or the opposite of false alerting rate, right? We want our positive predictive value to be high, we want our sensitivity to be high, and ideally we want to operate in a region here. And here, what we're showing is basically I took those four axes and I said all else equal, if all we did was go from the sort of curated narrow set of inputs to dramatically expand the set of inputs to include the vast complexity of multimodal data that exists, how would we do in terms of improved performance? And what we're showing here is nearly at 80 to 90% sensitivity range, the ability to improve alarm rates or reduce false alarm rates by nearly 20 to 30%. So very, very meaningful. The second slide, what I'm showing here now is that, okay, all else equal, if I kept the inputs the same, the learning strategy, of course, learning strategies interact with all of these. But learning strategy is the same. And what I did is change the quality of the labels, the quality of the data I'm learning from. And so this isn't changing the size of the data, but the quality of the actual label data. What we're seeing here is basically in the same sensitivity range, nearly 40 to 70% improvements in positive predictive value. So very meaningful. Now, in this third slide, what I'm showing here is that what if I kept all else equal and combined them? So both had better, richer inputs and better labels. The two actually interact, and we almost see 200 to 300% improvements in PPV. And then finally, sort of the other questions. I can hear a little bit of noise. I assume I should ignore it and keep going.
Yes, it turns out I was unmuted the entire time, and
Okay, but
there was background. I'm so sorry. Please
no
continue.
worries at all, Michael. We couldn't hear anything. So I spoke a little bit about the inputs and labels. I'm going to talk a little bit about the learning strategies. This seems most intuitive to this audience that the quality of the learning strategies should make a huge impact. Though in practice, what is really interesting is, if you remember this very famous Peter Norvig code, Peter Norvig is at Google in the 2010s, sort of as Google grew, there sort of grew this understanding that actually, I don't know the extent to which models really matter and the extent to which the learning strategies really matter. Ultimately, maybe it's just about the amount of data you have and the size of the data you have. And Turns out in this domain, because the data are so complex, because there's so much richness in the data, if you can truly exploit it, it dramatically impacts the quality of the models. So here's a paper, and I'm just going to present a couple examples to show. This was a paper published in TPAMI. What it talked about was intelligently leveraging missingness. So typically, the way people think about it is you take missing data and you either do last one carry forward, or you basically ignore the samples where there's, either you don't include the modalities where there's a lot of missingness, or if you include them, you basically use some simple imputation strategies for filling in the data. By contrast, if you're able to basically leverage the ability to use context to do intelligent interpolation, where you're not just filling it in, but you're maintaining uncertainty over what that value might have been. So that's number one. And number two, you leverage the uncertainty in each of the missing measurements to then project your uncertainty into the actual output. So let's say in this example, you're trying to forecast sepsis, no sepsis. You're giving your uncertainty, calibrated uncertainty intervals around your prediction in this, your probability of having sepsis. And then what's, and you can leverage that to now create what is an optimal stopping problem, right? So you can think about in a Bayes decision theoretic way, is it better for me to, stop, which is to alert, or am I unsure enough that maybe I should collect a little bit more data and then reconsider whether or not to alert it the next time? And when you take an approach like this, turns out you can dramatically improve again accuracy. So here what we're showing is compared to standard approaches, we used a whole slew of standard approaches. So I've simplified the slide greatly. Results and paper, we show that this sort of more intelligent wait and watch type strategy that leverages intelligent uncertainty quantification can actually at the same PPV dramatically increase sensitivity. So almost increase sensitivity by 30 to 40%. Sorry, 300 to 400%. So 3x to 4x improvement over standard approaches. So just using this one example, one type of strategy as an example, this is another example. Here, what we did was basically say when you're looking at large-scale observational data from EHRs, what we are really looking at is sequential data. And when we're looking at sequential data, a lot of the ways people would often learn predictive models is they would say, okay, let me look at the outcome and then work backwards to say, what is the data? Let's say you wanted to predict, should this person, is this person at risk for mortality? So a patient comes into the hospital at a given time, you're trying to predict risk of mortality. The standard practice was to say, let me look at whether or not they died in the hospital. That's the outcome. Let me look at all the inputs, all the variables that exist to data as the inputs, and then train a model to do prediction. Now this has become well understood, though wasn't well understood at the time, is that, this is a scenario where, you are the actions the physicians take dramatically impact the next step and the next step and the next step. So you're really doing learning in a sequential decision-making setting, but sequential decision-making setting where there's a model that is driving the actions. So if we can instead train sort of a risk objective, which is Y given X, but instead do a counterfactual objective, which is Y given X and do what actions they chose to do, which means you can now start to think about what were some alternative actions. You can actually, one, first of all, it's sort of theoretically the right thing to do. Empirically, you learn models that are way more sensical because it now actually understands the impact of actions on how that impacts predictive state. And now your forecast on the predictive state isn't just about the inputs that you happen to be in at the time of prediction, but also the possible action sequences that might go into impacting the outcome. So the ability to do leverage causal inference and counterfactual objectives to be able to improve training, another strategy, dramatically improve both the intelligibility, actionability, and quality of the models. And then finally, the last slide on modeling. This is more recent work from my lab. This is on taking transformer-based models that we have today, which are, have been shown to be very effective in language data, and really adapting it to multimodal data. And the ad adaptation to multimodal data with this kind of high-dimensional multimodal data isn't just as simple as let's just take the models, let's just take all our streaming data, turn it into inputs, and go forecast either regress or classify. But the challenge here is again taking into account the complexities of the individual modalities and how they relate in order to improve the quality of the resulting models and the intelligibility and actionability of the existing models. This is very new work. We have a number of papers here, but also lots in progress. Okay, so that's a little bit on the modeling front. I'm going to now talk a little bit about generalization when we move from lab to the real world setting. So in 2020, we wrote this paper. This was an invited perspective in the New England Journal of Medicine. And what it talked about was today in medicine, we're starting to consider, there's been a history of applying data-driven tools in the form of like what is called clinical decision support tools. But these CDS tools, we don't really think about them as like tools that like performance can really change and adapt and degrade over time as the, there are shifts in the environment, shifts in the population, shifts in practice patterns. That concept in sort of medicine was relatively underutilized and not as broadly understood. So in 2020, this perspective sort of took our experience in the AI front and married it with the experience in deploying practical tools to say, in practice, here are the 20 ways in which things can actually drift and shift. And these are different kinds of drifts and shifts with examples. And therefore, in order to build these a way to really deploy AI robustly, we need the ability to think about more holistically and systematically, how do we put a monitoring system in place that detects these and put correction loops in place that allows us to really give guarantees either on our system that it won't drift or shift or that it can auto-tune in order to get to a level of performance that is as expected and it's not behaving in unreliable ways. So it's a paper that's then spawned off a whole amount of a bunch of subsequent work. Here are some examples of shifts in practice. So, for instance, all this work in sepsis in around 2016, 2017 led to a big shift in policy where health systems started, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid started realizing we actually should be able to improve sepsis outcomes if we can figure out a way to incentivize providers to be more vigilant. And so they put requirements in place where they wanted to make sure there are certain tests were being measured in order to show that the providers were being vigilant, which means that the frequency with which certain tests were ordered went up, and the patterns of practice in how those tests were ordered and when those tests were ordered changed. So a system that leveraged as inputs test values and the frequency and measurement of those test values would suddenly no longer be like reliable. So here below is a paper where we talk about this and we show how if you had instead implemented systems with more robust learning algorithms that leverage counterfactual objectives and causal inference, you could have built systems that are more robust to these kinds of practice pattern changes. Another example, this is a paper from Mount Sinai where they showed that a system in imaging by mistake learned sort of a lot of local patterns around the device rather than the disease itself, and as a result, led to a model that sort of did very well in Marshall Hospital but didn't generalize. So, in order to be able to tackle these, there's sort of like two classes of categories, two categories of solutions. One is what can we do prior to deployment to mitigate these kinds of shifts? The second is what can we do post-deployment to monitor, detect, and enable learning for these kinds of shifts. We've spent quite a bit of time in both, and I'll give a little bit of glimpse into these areas. So the first area is sort of in machine learning, AI, we often think of it as invariant learning or shift-stable learning or robust learning, where you want model you the idea being you want model performance to not deteriorate in unanticipated ways. You want to be able to give guarantees about a model's performance under shifts. And sort of the question is, how do we do that? And so under invariant learning or shift-stable learning, there's a vast variety of methods that people have invented in order to be able to do that. One big class of these methods are what are called data-driven, domain-unaware. So essentially, the way it works is, you might say, okay, let me go collect data from lots of different environments. By collecting data from lots of different environments, my data inherently captures the kind of variation that exists, and I can now take my learning algorithm in order for it to generalize across these different environments. By construction, it'll be forced to learn ideas that are invariant or ideas that generalize across these different domains. So pros, super easy to use. Cons, you really require data collection from lots of different environments, which in medicine turns out to be a really expensive enterprise. But also, you don't have sort of, this is mostly empirically motivated, right? Like you don't have guarantees on performance. The guarantees are basically reliant on you collecting enough data that you can capture the desired invariances. So a different parallel type of approach is actually using domain knowledge to be able to enforce invariances. So here the idea is using causal graphs, you can use domain knowledge to specify shifts of interest, but also that you want to be invariant too, and then learn models that are stable against them. So as an example, like here, so there's a class of work we did in this area where essentially you take data from, and so very often when anybody wants to do causal inference, practical real world people get very scared because they're like, causal inference is very theoretical. We very rarely have access to a causal DAG. It's not very relevant. It's very hard to use in practice. It also requires understanding your data and domain, very painful exercise. So as a result, historically, these kinds of approaches have had less traction in practical environments. Since I have access to both the methods and the practice, I'm in a unique position to challenge that myth. So here, what we did was basically we took data, real-world practical data, and learned, partial DAGs from that data. So while you don't run the full causal graph, you can get partial DAGs from the data. That combined with your own understanding of the domain to start identifying desired invariances. So for instance, I won't go into the details of this, but basically in the examples that I just gave you, you can identify what are dependencies in the PDAG that you would like to be invariant to. And you can and then essentially you can think of any learning problem, any learning model. Like this approach is basically model agnostic. It doesn't matter whether you're using transformer-based models or just simple logistic regression or hierarchical mi mixture of experts, independent of the choice of model used, sort of the intuition of the method is as follows. You learn a PDAG, you specify the dependencies you don't want to learn. Typically, people think of this as pruning. So then you remove all those variables. But here, instead of removing those variables, what we're going to do is remove those edges on the graph, which means remove the learning method's ability to learn those dependencies. And now, effectively, what you end up learning is instead of learning one big consolidated model, which is one big joint distribution, using whatever advanced or fancy model you want to use, you are instead learning a collection of models that stitch together. And by doing so, you can actually build give guarantees that the resulting method, first of all, it's a wrapper method. It can be used with any state-of-the-art model that exists. So it's very flexible. You can give technical guarantees, you can give theoretical guarantees around the procedure sound, which means the return distribution is going to be invariant to the shifts that we dis specified as using the invariant spec diagram as desired. The procedure is complete, means if it fails, then there's no estimable invariant distribution. And you have to basically relax your constraints. You basically want to be able to say, okay, well, I can't get something that is, you're willing to take in more you're willing to take in more willingness to for the to be noisy, if you will, as you move from one environment to the other. And it's distributionally and it's also efficient. It's the best, most efficient possible estimator you can get. So super exciting, practical, flexible, and can be applied in practice. I link to a collection of papers on this topic here if anyone is curious. And there's been a fair amount of interest and follow-up in this. And so then moving to sort of the second topic here, which is more around mitigation post-deployment, an area where we're doing a whole lot of active work now. And so I'll talk a little bit about this. So here's kind of the idea. we have systems that are making prediction. The question is, can we put uncertainty, quantification, use uncertainty quantification methods to figure out, predictive confidence interval around the prediction? How much do I trust it? But then the exciting question then here is, one, can we get it? You could imagine if you could do this well. I already gave you earlier examples of how you can improve accuracy by basically building more intelligent policies that leverage this to change system behavior. But I'll show you later results where you can also use this to now change the way the humans are teaming with the system, right? Like you can essentially either enable intelligent suppression, you can enable more transparency, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So here again, there's been sort of in the last 4 to 5 years, great interest in, again, wrapper methods. So 10, 15 years ago, uncertainty quantification, we should often think of it as Bayesian methods, right? So the model is Bayesian. We're able to, if you can take a fully Bayesian view, you can propagate uncertainty all the way into any variable that you care to estimate. But turns out, like a lot of, we want to be able to, doing full Bayesian inference is extremely expensive in practice. We want to be able to leverage, other forms of modeling approaches that don't give you, that aren't Bayesian in nature, and still be able to do some level of uncertainty quantification. So these wrapper methods, the benefit is they do not constrain the model to a particular form. In these wrapper methods, you want these wrapper methods to be also accurate and informative. So what does it mean to be accurate and informative? It should contain the true label. We want to make sure that the well, containing the true label is easy if I say my uncertainty estimate is like, very get wide. So you also want the uncertainty estimate to be not too wide. And so you want it to be narrow, and narrow is informative. And then you want it to be sample efficient, which means if, distance shifts do occur, you want to be able to recognize it as quickly as possible. You want it to be computationally efficient, means you can implement these kinds of practices and approaches in real world. Otherwise, it's expensive. And you want to have guarantees to the extent possible, which means you want to be able to say something about the quality of your estimates. So in practice, sort of the challenges in the methods that exist has been twofold. First, a lot of the methods, where people were working in theory were often assuming data IID, but real world data, like I showed you with the drifts and shifts, are not IID. And then second is that you want to be able to use in real time world, in real world, you kind of need to do a trade off between the computational demands as well as the statistical demands. Means if something does drift, as early as possible, you identify it. And the reason you want that is because, in some, many of these high stakes applications we're talking about, there could be patient harm. So the ability to know early or as quickly as possible is actually quite helpful. So here, what I'm doing is basically the work in our lab essentially works in a few different areas. So what I'm doing here is kind of laying out the landscape approaches in distribution-free uncertainty quantification. Here on the y-axis is statistical efficiency, on the x-axis is computational efficiency. And traditional methods were either statistically very efficient, but computationally inefficient, or computationally very efficient, but statistically inefficient. So the question was, is there a way to, like, trade off the two? Number one, so that's sort of one area where we pushed. And second, to be able to do it in a way where we can relax assumptions around the data not being IID, but that there are other forms of shifts. And so in work, published here in papers in EURIPS and ICML and a few others, what we showed is methods that allow us to both relax assumptions and, we point to other related work here. Super exciting area, lots of exciting work to be done in terms of how we can achieve both better trade-offs, but also relax the assumptions to be more favorable to real-world scenarios like standard covariate shift, feedback covariate shift, and then more recently, in a recent paper that came out in ICML, talked about how we can actually really do this in get these kinds of estimates to be high quality with guarantees under not just standard and covariate, but multi-feedback covariate shift and really other kinds of more complex drifts and shifts that can occur. I know in the interest of time, I won't have the chance to go into any one of these papers in great levels of detail, but I'll sort of tie it all together and how these methods can now be in practice. What does this enable? So here essentially, one way to think about this is, we're now able to use these methods to start implementing more intelligent interfaces for suppression. So here's actually I'll come back to that in two seconds. I want to talk about this one more workaround drift and shift detection before we talk about the use of these methods for in practice. So another type of example. So previously we were talking about uncertainty quantification and getting access to predictive intervals, which we can now use for designing more intelligent interfaces. This is another piece of work. This is with my postdoc, Joab Wald, where what we basically looked at is during COVID, one of the interesting things that happened was, there's an algorithm for sepsis detection that many hospitals used. And turns out COVID mimics a lot of the rules that these or predictors that the existing algorithm was using. So as a result, there was it started firing all over the place, leading to alarm fatigue, but also risk of harm to patients. And so so naturally you can think of this as open set domain adaptation, the idea of like, can we identify novel classes and novel classes that are coming up and identify them again as quickly as possible? But traditionally, when people are talking about novel category detection or open set domain adaptation, they're again thinking about it in scenarios where there's very rigid assumptions about the background distribution, which is the background distribution isn't shifting at all. But that's again not true in the real world, right? Like you go from the winter to the summer, there's a shift in populations. Though, like there could be other kinds of shifts in practice patterns, et cetera. So the idea here was to think about, can we relax this assumption around, the background distribution to enable or allow benign shifts or shifts that are more reflective of the real world? And so here, what we came up with was some really nice, or more like Yoav came up with those really, really nice ways to what we call the SCAR assumption, which is the let's assume that in the background distribution, the appearance of novel subgroups or certain kinds of anomalies are rare. And so if we can say that certain kinds of anomalies are rare, then under that scenario, we can basically give guarantees on our ability to detect and detect as quickly and early as possible. And it's called scarcity of unicorns assumption. And dramatically improve again our ability to detect in real world scenarios these kinds of changes in okay, so let's now talk a little bit about how are we doing on time. I can't see my clock.
Yeah, it's 7 minutes before 1 p.m. East Coast time. So
Okay,
it'd be great if
perfect.
you could kind of land the plane.
Lovely. Okay, so I'll try to land the plane in the next 7 minutes. I think I should be successful. So here, what we're going to talk a little bit about is we talked a lot about like methods in terms of translation from the lab to the real world. Now a little bit about human machine teaming and use. And so here, essentially, this was a paper that came out in Nature Digital Medicine, where we basically spoke about where we sort of did a study on what are mental models of physician trust and how, what are barriers to getting physician trust and, what are some roadblocks we need to uncover or come in order to build trust with machine learning systems. Super interesting because it taught us a lot about like both models of trust, but also like some barriers we would need to think about in order to be able to build systems that would get adopted. We tackled several of those learnings and then building a system that we then presented within that pragmatic study and trial that I spoke about and showed that, and in a quantitative study then showed we were able to drive very high adoption. And so I'll talk a little bit about, there are some kinds of learnings, which was more around you need the system to be accurate. If the system has very high false alerting rate or it doesn't give valuable insight early enough, ultimately clinicians are very smart. They're not going to use it because they don't see the data being informative. So that's sort of one very high level. Number two, like they have mental models of how the disease works. So if it contradicts the way it works, it's, they're less likely to trust it. So again, thinking about intelligibility is very important. Turns out they don't care a whole lot about interpretability. So for instance, the example they would often give is, I don't need to know how every bit of my fMRI machine works, or I don't know how what neurons are firing for my colleague who I trust to give me a diagnosis or to help me with a case, but I do understand the way they think and why they think what they think, or I have the ability to take what they're telling me and use it in enhancing my own way of reasoning. And so those were some really interesting ideas in basically being able to build a teaming model where there's a very clear role for what information the system is providing and how is it providing, and does the clinician understand what information is being provided in a manner that they know how to ingest and incorporate into their own reasoning procedure. And then that allows them to be more effective with it. Now, when you go down that line, turns out there are also lots of ways to in which you can create under-reliance. So under-reliance is basically the system doesn't, the clinician doesn't trust the system and won't use it. But there's also over-reliance, which is you start trusting it too much, which is a problem when the AI is not right. So this piece of these collections of work kind of stemmed from that, which is starting to think about under-reliance and over-reliance and interventions we can do based upon the outputs we've generated to improve, to study over and under reliance. And so a couple of quick takeaways, again, in the interest of time, won't go into depth, but here what we're doing is, again, it's an RCT, it's a randomized trial with like where we are presenting AI advice versus we're presenting the AI and we're presenting different forms of advice, correct advice versus incorrect advice. And then we're also changing the interface, which is in we're presenting different types of explanations along with the advice. We're also changing whether or not we give whether the AI's confidence is exposed to the user. This is a paper in radiology that's coming up if for anyone who's curious. A bunch of really interesting experiments here. We also, from a user perspective, had experts and non-experts. So experts means in medicine, they see this, these are specialists, they see this as their domain. Non-experts meaning they're still medical experts, but not maybe specialists in this domain. So like emergency medicine physicians would be considered non-task experts. Radiologists would be considered task experts for imaging data. And so some couple of interesting takeaways here. So turns out basically there's some kinds of explanations if physicians like so we measured impact on diagnostic accuracy. And when what we saw was basically under correct advice, they were, diagnostic performance improved a great deal more when the explanation was a local type of explanation as opposed to a global type of explanation. So local type of explanation means it localizes where in the image something is wrong and why, and global is it says, because of other images like this image, let me give you some examples of other images where this thought to be true. Now, local image turns out local advice, they know how to ingest it better, they know how to reason it with it better, and as a result, their performance is impacted more. Now, the good news is when the AI is correct, it actually improves the diagnostic performance because they're likely to rely on it compared to when you're given global advice. So high confidence local AI explanations. Now, even more interesting, they're more likely to sway non-task experts than task experts. There's, now evidence in the literature that task experts, they're more likely to be biased against AI, which is if they know it's AI advice, they don't tend to take it as seriously. But if the same advice came, but you told them it's from a human, they're more likely to take it. Turns out non-task experts have less of this bias, and non-task experts, the local explanations are very, very helpful. So in a lot of these access type applications where we're moving applications into a setting like the primary care advice, primary care scenario, or the ED scenario where we are trying to move from specialists to there's sort of this exciting insight here that you can design them in a way that non-task experts are likely to rely and use that helps improve diagnostic performance. There's also sort of this second really interesting concept of like trust and simple trust. And the way we measured simple trust was this, in a given image, there's a whole bunch of concepts. They're basically annotating the image, or not annotating, but giving the impression on this image of chest X-ray of a number of different clinical things that could be going on. So what we're measuring is basically the AI. Let's say there are six things going on. Let's say the AI identified four of them, and the expert identified two of them, and they agreed on two of the six. So that would be percentage alignment is 2 out of 6. And then the question is, how quickly did they align? Like, how long did this hover on the image? And if you could take the percentage alignment divide by the amount of time it took, it's a metric for measuring simple trust. And so the idea is like, if the explanations make sense to them and they're able to get to the right answers faster, that's good. That makes the numerator go up. If it takes them, they can get there quickly, that makes the denominator go down. So simple trust goes up. And so I think this is the last data slide. But basically, again, interesting takeaways here. Local explanations, easier, drive simple trust, means physicians are more likely to both agree, but also get there faster compared to global explanations. On the flip side, it's also possible to be overly reliant. And one of the interesting next steps from here is something like, can we like maybe take other mechanisms like maybe thinking of the uncertainty interval or the confidence of the AI as way to modulate, when to trust and when not to trust so that they're less likely to over-rely on the scenarios where the AI is wrong, and then they are more likely to, they continue to adopt and perhaps improve reliance in the scenarios where the AI is correct, because that would lead to a system that would be more performant. So with that, I'll start wrapping up, which is to say, it's extremely hard to do research where it both has good, sound theoretical, methodologic foundations, but also is married to practical real-world problems. It's interesting. I feel like as a faculty, as a professor of computer science, it's extremely easy to be carried away or to be incentivized to just write, papers in ICML and Europe's and machine learning venues where, the bar for the quality in terms of our deep understanding of the problem and whether the quality of the evaluations are really all that good can really sway us into believing something is actually working when it's not, or can sway us into believing something is very useful when it's not. So it takes a lot more work to be able to understand the real world, but deep understanding of real world requirements often inspires, I think, some of the most exciting foundational work. It's slower, it's more painful, but I think it's just exciting what is possible. So I want to encourage and embrace the marriage of the two. Being able to, the latter is real painful work, but again, I think it's from a reward perspective, very valuable in terms of leading us to innovations that truly matter in practice. And then just a last thread about treating algorithms like prescription drugs. I think as I've spent more time, moving my early research was in AI and machine learning, but more sort of focused in robotics or kind of domain agnostic. And in the last decade, I've spent more and more time learning the innards of medicine. Kind of see the rigor with which people pursue under deeply understanding whether or not something is working. And I think as the two get married, there's such an excite like as we see AI getting out in the real world more and more, real opportunity to bolster AI safety research. Today, a lot of AI safety research is what is focused on what I call AI alignment, which is, for a very highly capable AI system, is it showing undesirable behavior? I mean, like for instance, it's taking control. It's starting to do things that we weren't meaning for it to do by taking control. But I also think in parallel, there's the significant opportunity to understand AI risk, leveraging existing regulatory lens of risk-benefit trade-off, and then really thinking about this notion of reliability around intended use. So we had sort of an expectation of what we wanted it to do. The question is it doing that in the real world? And that sort of notion of reliability is where a lot of the second half of my talk focused, and where I think there's a lot to be done in accelerating AI adoption. This is my last slide. Thank you very much.
All right. There's thunderous applause that is being completely filtered out by the internet, but I feel it in my bones. Thank you so much for working through that and with us. Yeah, it's a lot of material, a lot of technical stuff, because there's the whole medicine side of things, there's the whole statistics side of things, and then there's the whole computer science side of things. And you really do bring all those things together to have a positive impact. So I think it's just delightful to get to hear about it. So I'm very glad that we've got some questions that have cropped up. We've got about 10 minutes that we could engage with you on questions. So let me kick things off. One of the things that we ask our speakers to do often is to say just a little bit about how you got here. So what was the path that you took that brought you to this particular topic and studying it in this particular way?
Yeah, so my early background, so I grew up in India and it was perfectly reasonable to be a nerd in India. So I got into computer science and AI research quite early. And in particular, this was like 96, 97, 98. I know there are people in SAIS who are doing it, but it certainly wasn't a very popular field to the same extent it is today. And most of my interest was in building machines that were smart and intelligent, could do things for me because I'm a pretty lazy person. So that I thought was like the coolest thing ever. And then fast forward, actually had almost little to no interest in biology and medicine, which is kind of pathetic, given sort of what you heard today on the talk. And then around 2008, 9, 10, while I was at Stanford, High Tech Act was just about to be, and sort of got interested in the sort of got exposed to the kinds of challenges that I thought would become challenges as these new kinds of data came to be. And the need for AIML to work in these kinds of settings. And that was just fascinating to me. The potential for impact was fascinating, but also realizing that it would require really getting in and understanding the weeds, a different field, which was highly complicated and often daunting, I think, as a computer scientist. But I was going through an early midlife crisis around, what was I going to be as I grew up? And it felt like this was a huge area, untapped area where we really ought to be spending more time anyway. So that's how I got interested and then had fascinating collaborators who brought me along.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that with us. Because yeah, I think you're right about the really having to roll up your sleeves and become an expert in this other domain is so daunting to so many people. But I think what you've helped highlight is how important it is to actually have that kind of impact. It's a computer scientist who just say, "Hey, I'm inspired by health or electricity grids or whatever it is," and then just make kind of a formal model of it and study that formal model are never going to have the same kind of real world impact as the people who get in there and figure out what's actually going on. So
I want to add one little line there, which is not really a plug in any way, but I actually felt like for me, moving to a place like Hopkins was also very critical for that. Like, once I started to feel like this is an area I wanted to learn more, I think what has been really exciting for me at a place like Hopkins is to see like they really encourage, like, because of APL, because of all of the history there of collaborating with DARPA and various agencies around real world problems. The opportunity to like an environment that encouraged that broad curiosity, which there are departments where that would not be, that's not valued to the same extent. So that really sort of also helped shape, how I developed as a researcher.
do you have any advice for people who are out there who want to study these things, but they're afraid that it's going to have negative career repercussions?
I mean, I think like, for this is going to also sound probably quite terrible on a call on this kind of audience, but sort of I used to often say I care about the work and the results almost more than I care about being a researcher, a professor, and a successful, I was okay if I didn't get tenure. I was also completely okay if I didn't sort of the I mean, it all turned out to be highly like in my favor. Having said that, I felt like that helped relax some of the anxieties. Sort of the advice is just really go find other people you can partner with and come along, and then find mentors, senior mentors who have been successful in this way and sort of, try to understand. Because there are also lots of ways in which you can do applied research gone wrong, right? So the scenarios where you're basically not able to do impactful work in either. Because you've spent so much time being so far deluded that you weren't able to really leverage your strengths in either. And that's the failure scenario you're trying to avoid. And so, if you can have the right mentors and you're sort of being very, it's definitely the harder thing to do, but it's doable.
Outstanding. We got a couple questions specifically about the recording of this talk and the slides. And if you didn't see it, Edgar, who's our IT specialist, kind of handling these talks, said that those will become available on the website. So know that those are covered. We're not going to ask Suchi to directly email each of you with the slides. So we have them. We'll have them posted. All right. So a lot of the questions came in anonymously, but this one has a name on it. Syed Ramiz Naqvi asked, "I keep coming across discussion on AI's impact on healthcare, especially patient safety. The impact can be negative or positive. What do you think the most important negative impact or concern in this context is nowadays?"
I think the most likely negative impact is basically over-reliance when the AI is incorrect, right? So we want to build AI in a way where it's deeply validated to be correct. We want the build the to build the interfaces in a way that we can promote reliance and reliance in the right scenarios and an over-reliance, avoid over-reliance in the wrong scenarios.
Very good. This one maybe is more technical than I actually understand, but I hope maybe you'll understand it. What were the performance metrics to compare against CDS tools?
Yeah. So interestingly, it's extremely common when we try to compare performance to use like what I call lab metrics. So lab metrics are like typical model metrics like accuracy and things like ROC curve, AUC ROC and things like that. We definitely want to do that, but that alone is not enough. And that was actually one of our very early learnings that shaped the methods that we developed. So for instance, my answer to this is actually pretty long if I go into the details of every metrics, but the super short answer was we really wanted to understand current standard of care and think about working backwards from current standard of care. Like, how do we measure performance against physician today's standard of care, which is physician performance? So that's number one. Number two, against other alternative tools, so other tools they might be using. And then based on that, come up with meaningful metrics that actually quantify impact. So that means, is it about earlier detection? Is it about earlier detection in all types of cases? Is it about reducing a false alarm? Why is that a problem? Maybe because it's causing context switching, which is costing time. So we worked backwards to come up with sort of metrics that are more relevant in practice. And then we kept going backwards to say, how does this then translate into model metrics? And how we measure it in terms of model metrics to be able to get to the result. And then ultimately, you can do all the positing you want. There's eventually, because of the lack of very clean gold standards, the real world implementations where you actually get to see in the diversity of cases what happened in practice. And so that was sort of the where the real world trial really came to be.
So there's a couple versions of this question, and I think this related to your answer to the previous question. So maybe this is a quick one, but how are physicians convinced to accept the technology thought readily? Like you said, 89% versus normal 10% for other tools, I believe you said.
Yeah, that I think that's actually a pretty like there are probably if there was one hill you could climb, then we would all climb that hill and we'd be done. And turns out there are like 15 or 16 hills we have to climb along the way. And some of the intuitions I gave was around improving performance. Some of it was around the way the information was delivered. What was the teaming interface? How you implement matters a lot in terms of gaining trust. Is it easy to use? Is it in the way they expect it to be? The things that are novel, do they understand why it is novel? Like, is it in a language that they understand? Does it follow their trust model? And those are sort of the kinds of things we had to do to drive adoption. And you know, that paper we have that I pointed to would be an interesting one to look at, just a starting point.
Nice. All right, we're almost out of time, but let me see if I can squeeze in another question. Sanjana Mendu asked, "Thank you for the insightful talk. How do you recommend navigating health-related ML problems with a much narrower time window for both monitoring behavior and adapting to model responses? For example, how do you foresee these models impact clinical practice in domains like surgery?"
I actually think the setting in which the setting that I use is actually quite close to the setting where it's real time, impacts in real time, and the window of opportunity is like short, relatively short on the typical, like, you know, there's chronic disease like diabetes, et cetera, or COPD, where maybe there's short-term effects, but there's lots of long-term effects. But in the scenarios that I spoke about, like surgery would be an example, you know, there's lots of shorter-term things you're looking at. So hopefully the work I presented here was actually more of a model where even in the most toughest of environments where you need rapid response, you can actually kind of make these kinds of methods come to life.
This is a variation of a question from Mutin Yilmaz. Uncertainty modeling is really important in the work that you're doing, and of course, in this domain as a whole. Where in the modeling process do you think are the most important places to consider uncertainty? So can you imagine considering uncertainty at the very beginning, before you've even done the modeling?
Oof. I think pretty much everywhere is my answer to this question. Like, the more you do, the better you do. So it's more like how much money do you have from the various agencies to think about what to model, and then you can kind of push your limit on taking advantage of it.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. All right. So we are out of time. I want to, again, thank you so much for coming, participating in this and sharing your insights with folks. There are